Before we begin this episode, I want to give a huge shout out to all of our patrons over on patreon.com/bitterbrownfems. Without your support, we would not be able to make this podcast possible. If you want to support us, feel free to join our Patreon, and you can find the link in the description. Right now, I'd particularly like to give a humongous shout out to all of our patrons in the BBF, BFF tier. That would be Anna C, Anna H, Cassandra G, Christian G, Cynthia P, Delia, Elizabeth O, Eveline, Guadalupe F, Catlin, Marisol S, Laura R, and Nini. All right, y'all are amazing. Thank y'all so much for your support. And again, you can find the link to support us in the description.
We'll do it live. We'll do it live. Fuck it. Do it live. I'll write it and we'll do it live. Fucking thing sucks.
Hi, and welcome to another episode of Bitter Brown Femmes. This is Cassandra.
Where are you coming from, Cassandra?
From El Paso, Texas.
Yeah, we gotta let these kids know. Otherwise, they're gonna be like, why is that so far away? Bitch, because we're like two states away. I don't know my geography. Hi, I'm Ruben, and I am coming to you from Los Angeles. And there's another episode of Bitter Brown Femmes. The show where we dismantle shit while talking shit. I'm going to make that tagline stick because we need a tagline to stick. Yeah. So how have you been, Cassandra?
I've been good, actually. Yeah. What have you been? This week, I am not a mother.
Ooh.
My child is on vacation, so I am on vacation too. All
right. Don't listen to CPS.
So I've just been... I've just been enjoying, like, just, you know... just being alone.
Yeah.
No responsibilities for a week.
What?
Hot girl summer.
Cassandra said you can't have hot girl summer with children. She said children ruin that shit.
Correct. Stop.
Yeah, I've been good. Thanks for asking.
I was about to ask. But you know, talking shit about children as always. But how have you been?
I am giving a voice to the voiceless, and so it's important to have differing opinions sometimes.
Sure.
She's gonna drag me later. No, but I've been alright. Just like, you know, trying to remember what sleep feels like now that my first year of grad school is over. Yeah, so excited about having a summer, not excited about having to move, but you know what, I will embrace change. So I feel like, all right, this is my life, let's make the most of it. today we have a very special guest, Ariana Brown, who is a poet, artist, speaker, and educator. She comes from Texas, but she previously lived elsewhere for her MFA program and has been traveling the country, spreading the good word, and the good word being her poetry, and also educating a lot of folks along the way on a lot of issues that folks have had maybe trouble grappling with in the last few years. But I think that folks like Ariana have really set their foot down and made a space to talk about. Their work is centered around blackness and rejecting kind of the colonial nature of Latinidad, while also exploring the limitations and expanding on what gender means, right? Among other things, including history, both familial and cultural. So I'll give it up for Ariana Brown. Thank you for joining
us. Thank you. That was such a great, like, off the top of the head bio. Thank you.
Your new book, We Are Owed, which is due out when, Ariana?
On July 29th, but you can pre-order it now.
Pre-order it now. Like, just shut this off, pre-order, come back, so you don't forget. And also, before, there's something that I start doing, too, is that, like, what are your handles? Where can people follow you? Because, like, what if they like stop listening halfway through because they're offended.
No, very important question. I'm Ariana the Poet on all social media. On well, I'm not on all social media. I'm not on TikTok. I'm not young enough for that.
How is Gen Z gonna find your poems?
I know.
You have to start reciting your poetry with different like panoramic shots of San Antonio. Like, in the back. That's how the poets be doing it. You know.
I would hate that. Oh my goodness. But no, you can find, I also have a website, arianabrown.com, and you can find all of my stuff on there, or you can just type my name into YouTube, because I do come from a slam poetry background, so a lot of my stuff you can find just anywhere. But yeah, Ariana the Poet, if you have a hard time looking for me.
Ariana the Poet, and then Ariana Brown on YouTube and arianabrown.com. But your book, We Are Owed, which people can pre-order now. Two questions, like, you know, what is the back, you know, the sleeve introduction to the book, right? What's the hook for it? And then what was the process of conceptualizing the, you know, the art? How did you come about, like, I'm going to write about all these things and put them together, right? Was it intuitive? Was it, you know, work across the ages and you're just like, this all, I can make it work together?
Yeah, it was definitely not a work across the ages. Everything that I wrote for this project was specifically written for this manuscript. There's a ton of stuff that didn't make it into it as well, but this book is 6 years in the making. So it's been a very intentional, research-driven process putting all of this together. The basic introduction to the book is that it's called We Are Owed, period. And it's about, for me, relationships between Black people in the spaces through which I've lived most of my life, right? So mostly in Central Texas, but also in places like Houston and Galveston, where my family is from, and also in Mexico City, where I took a six-week study abroad a few years ago. And so it's a lot of thinking through my own loneliness. You know, I talked about growing up on the south side of San Antonio, but I was also the only Black person in my house, in my neighborhood, in most of the schools that I attended. I was the only Black person on that study abroad trip to Mexico City. And so I think for a long time, I have been looking for other Black people who are in those same spaces as me. And I'm very interested in the origin stories of how we came to be in those places. And so history for me is a way to explore how we got here and what the conditions of our lives are here, right? How we are perceived, how we are treated by others, because there is a legacy of that, right? Like, you can't talk about Blackness in Texas or in Mexico without also talking about the transatlantic slave trade, and all of the history that's happened between then and now, and how it's really unending, right? Like, those links are there. You just have to look for them. And so a lot of the poems, I mentioned that they're research driven. I have a foundational degree in African diaspora studies, as well as Mexican American studies. And when I entered Mexican American studies classrooms, I had a lot of questions, because I feel like in academia, but also just like in the world at large, we tend to talk about Latinx history and Black history as though they are two separate things. But when you come from a place like Texas, where Black people and Spanish descended people have been in constant proximity for a very long time, it's kind of ridiculous to think about them as two separate histories, right? And so this book was me kind of looking through documents, reading histories of enslavement in Texas and in Mexico, and trying to find some kind of precedence for Black life in these places, and put that in relation to my own stories, my own personal stories of growing up and moving through these places, as a way of finding community and also understanding myself.
I think that historical part is, I think, the thread in a lot of ways that binds a lot of these together. I like that you quote not only like radical thinkers, but also your own critical thoughts in what I perceive to be the introduction to each section, right? Like, you have a Marta Menchaca quote, you have your own analysis in the first part, you have a Wikipedia entry in another part. So it is both like this artistic expression and also this like presentation of research findings that I see working together. And I think what that communicates immediately to me is that like history and like this, you know, social cultural study of things, like these are not objective things. Like you have, they are, the way we receive them, the way they are communicated, are completely informed by who is telling the story, right?
Yes, absolutely.
I think one of the pieces that spoke to me, or one of the examples of like the introduction to research or to the different sections is when you began talking about Esteban, one of the enslaved people introduced by Narvaez and who participated in the first expedition to set foot in Texas, right? And then you continuously bring them up when talking about like Guillermo and so forth. How was it, how did it feel to discover this part of Black history, and also how did it feel to incorporate it, or like how did you decide to incorporate him into your work?
Right. Yeah, no, that's a really good question. I mean, I think something that feels, I'm not sure how to say it, but something that's really common, I think, when you're studying an archive of slavery, is that when you find out about an enslaved person who you want to learn more about, there's either there's very little documentation about them, or the documents that you can find are very fragmented, right? And they're never written from that person's perspective. It's always the person who owned them, right, writing about them, or some kind of like colonial official writing about that person. So you never get these like diary entries or things that the person themselves wrote. And so when I found the story of Esteban, I was actually in a class with Magda Menchaca at UT Austin. It was a course that was that kind of chronicled the history of the conquest, right? And so Esteban is part of that story because he was enslaved by Panfilo de Narváez, who was a Spanish colonizer, conquistador, who was trying to map Texas, Florida, and the U.S. Southwest. And so Esteban was brought along this trip with... I think they started out with something like 200 men. They were trying to get to Florida from Mexico, from current day, present day Mexico. They were trying to get to Florida and they were shipwrecked. And there were only, I think, 5 survivors. And Esteban was one of those survivors. And so they ended up shipwrecked in Galveston, Texas, which is not a well-known story about Galveston. A lot of people know that the Juneteenth announcement of 1865 was delivered in Galveston, but a lot of people don't know about the story of this like handful of conquistadores and this enslaved Black person named Esteban who passed through this place after being shipwrecked, trying to stay alive, and then continue to walk the rest of Texas. And Esteban is credited with being like the first person to map Texas. And he also walked through places like Arizona and New Mexico as kind of like a guide and a scout. And there are even stories of kind of him being like a curandero and this like interpreter and interlocutor between indigenous groups in these areas and the Spaniards. And so something that's interesting for me, period, about Esteban is just knowing the history of other Black people who literally walked the land before I did and whose stories precede mine. But also there's always for me this question of agency, right, with enslaved people, because it's almost impossible to know how much of Esteban's actions were his own choice and how much of those were things he was forced to do by the people who tried to own him. And there's also the truth that like so many other enslaved people, there are no surviving images of him. So we don't know what he looked like. We don't know what his voice sounded like. It's not known if he has descendants. It seems like he was killed before he was able to have children. And so there are all of these like gaps in the story of Esteban's life and his legacy. And I'm interested in those gaps. And because I don't know a whole lot about him, everything I know about him is in the book in that one little section, I can't write a poem that's about Esteban because I don't know enough. And so then instead I have to write a poem that's about my story in relation to Esteban, of me being present in a similar place that he probably walked, and thinking about how Blackness gets erased in sort of these origin stories of how Texas came to be, of how Mexico came to be, and kind of reinserting Esteban's story into that narrative or that place.
I see this as well. I mean, not immediately, because I had to ask you about it too, but I see this like composition of like self in relation to ancestry and missing documentation when you speak of Yanga, right? In your poems, about you and Yanga. Did you want to explain to folks who maybe have never heard of them, like who Yanga is and like what inspired you to write about them as a relative that you might know?
Yeah, I really like this word relative that you're using, because that feels appropriate. Gaspar Yanga was an African man who was enslaved and brought to Mexico City and then forced into enslavement on the Spanish sugar plantations in Veracruz. Pretty early on in his enslavement, he escaped into the mountains in that area and remained a Maroon for 30 years. And during that time, he aided other people in escaping and maintained a Maroon community of Black and Indigenous escaped slaves. And during this time, they also would constantly antagonize and attack Spaniards and merchants that were kind of carrying, supplies to and from Mexico City, which was one of the major slave ports in Mexico at the time. And because the Spaniards could never catch them, which is a wild thing to think about for 30 years to elude capture and continually be attacking Spaniards, the Spaniards were kind of tired of Yanga and his group, and so they tried to fight them several times. And eventually they kind of gave up and granted freedom to Yanga and the Maroon community that he founded, or that he was a huge part of. And that settlement that they were granted became the first free African settlement in the Americas. A lot of people don't know that. I didn't know this until a few years ago. I learned about it the very last week of my study abroad in Mexico City, where we had been studying Mexican history, and I had never heard Yanga's name. I actually learned about it from a YouTube video, a 3-minute-long illustrated YouTube video that's written and illustrated by a great writer named David Heredia. And I was so emotional, I think, about learning about him. Because I feel like, growing up in Texas, being Mexican-American and also studying Mexican-American studies, I felt like I had had plenty of opportunities to learn about Yanga, and no one had ever told me about him. So I think there was like this sense of betrayal in not knowing, not being given this history. But I also, I think, was feeling very relieved because I had had such a lonely experience being in Mexico City because I am Black. And I think it felt comforting to know, again, right, that there's precedence that other Black people have been in this space before, have also to know that another Black person who is also not from Mexico, like me, but has a tense relationship with it, to say the least, and wanted to be freed from it, and was actively creating the conditions for liberation for him and his people. That meant a lot to me. And so I felt a particular kind of closeness with him at that moment in time, and I still do. And because his story is not well known, and there's not a lot to know about him, again, because there's so few surviving documents, again, no surviving images of him, that I feel like it's important to share what I know. But again, because he's someone that I don't know a lot about, there's many poems in the book about him, but most of the poems are about my relationship with him. It's me asking him questions because I don't have the answers, or me imagining us doing things together, right? Like building a boat, or he's singing me a lullaby so I can fall asleep at night. And so I think of him like almost as a protector, because that's what he was. And in my mind is still kind of what he is.
That's powerful. I was going to mention also, as someone from Texas. You know, I was born and raised here. I'm still here in El Paso, which is, like we were talking about, every part of Texas is so different. It's Texas is so huge. I feel like people kind of understand, but they don't understand unless they live here. Like, you know, like I'm closer to LA than sometimes driving to a show in Dallas. So our experiences are very, my experiences are different from someone in the other border city, which is RGB, right? Like, even though we're both, we share similarities, it's still very different. But I do appreciate it nonetheless, as someone from Texas, like, you know, just learning, cause there's a lot of history that I don't know either. And also you know, we can talk about like, that's intentional with the U.S. education system, especially in Texas. I was going to say, how you mentioned we're talking specifically in Texas, like we're trying to separate, you know, this is Black history and this is Texas history, or this is Black history, this is Mexican history, you know, which that overlaps. But I was just going to mention, in like the other day I saw a tweet from a Twitter handle, Prof. Jay Wallace. I don't know if y'all follow him, Javier Wallace. Yeah. So he had actually tweeted a thread about Tejanos and like Latinx's history with Juneteenth, which is coming up. So it just reminded me of that. And it was just a lot of in the thread that I didn't know either. And even though I live, you know, like I said, I've lived here, but it was kind of like, I'm just going to read the tweet real quick and then we can show the thread, because I'm not going to, you know, post all that. But it's pretty much, if you identify as Latinx, you have to understand Juneteenth. There's not a Juneteenth in how we understand it if Tejanos don't broker deals with Anglos to expand race-based enslavement into Coahuila y Texas. And then, you know, here are a couple of Tejano-Anglo collabs. And it's like a thread of, you know, how Tejanos also enslaved Black people. And just like in relation to Juneteenth. And it had reminded me also of, speaking of how shitty El Paso is sometimes, there's like this, you know, because we're at the border and there's this organization, nonprofit who does like Hugs Not Walls something. So they pretty much open the border and for like 3 minutes and let the families kind of see each other, which is, yes, it's like, I'm not against that, obviously. I mean, it's shitty that it's a whole other conversation that has to happen. But they were, whoever, I can't think of the org right now, they kind of are doing this thing on Juneteenth. And I felt very bothered by it, because I was like, this is not like how it's kind of like co-opting like Juneteenth. Not that like, you know, Black migrants don't exist, or it just felt like they were using like this very like specific like non-Black Latinx org using Juneteenth as a way to forward something. It just felt really messy. And then I saw this thread about Juneteenth and that connection, and it kind of reinforced that. So I just wanted to add that it wasn't really a question, but it was just like a lot of our history that we're taught or not taught, and we can all, you know, I think a lot of us have like done research on our own outside of like school, because it's not like taught, even if it's just like a meme or like you said, a YouTube video or something you saw. Like it is shitty that we don't, and I feel that maybe if we did learn, I mean, the topic right now is like critical race theory, right, and how they're trying to ban it, and it's like we don't even get enough of it, I feel, and so to ban the very little actual history that we have is so damaging, especially to people here in places like Texas, where it's like everything is so limited to us. But yeah, like I said, it wasn't a question, it was just like seeing the Juneteenth reference and to Tejanos, because I've always been really interested in like that word itself and how people still identify as Tejano, right? I think like at one point I identified as Tejana just because like I heard it, but then I was like, I don't really feel like Tejana, because like I said, El Paso is so removed from the rest of Texas that
that's
Tejana
true.
And Tejano, like it makes sense, because I'm like, oh, I'm like, I'm Mexican-American and I live in Texas, but then when I, like, actually stopped to think about it, I'm like, I don't feel this connection to that word, just because I'm so far from, like, the Tex-Mex situation and, like, other, you know, San Antonio and Austin and stuff. But then, like, the more I dug into, like, what does Tejano actually mean and, like, who uses this still, and it's very anti-Black, and it's kind of, like, mestizo, mestiza, but we don't have to talk about that. We don't want to, but sorry. Those were just thoughts I was having, again, as someone, you know, who's also here in Texas.
Sure. No, I'm glad you brought up Professor Javier Wallace. I'm so grateful for all the information that he shares online. I feel like I learn a lot from just following him on Twitter. And I know he and Dash Harris co-teach workshops together on Black Latin American history. And every time I see information that Javier Wallace shares in particular, because I feel like he focuses a lot on Texas and like Black Mexican Tejano Anglo relations in Texas and on both sides of the Texas-Mexico border. Every time he shares information, I'm always like, I wish that I could have taken a class with him. I wish that I could have studied under him, because I think there's also, too, for me, this disappointment of not being able to find this information until much later, right? Like I said, I have a degree in two ethnic studies departments, and I'm finding this information out, you know, in tweets, which is great that it's accessible in that way, but I think it's frustrating because I would have loved to take, you know, a very in-depth semester-long, you know, course of study and made projects around this and had that kind of mentorship and guidance to walk me through this history and to be in discussion groups with people, you know, which I know is still possible, like, in a different way, but I think I'm often in this place of, like, longing to know more or wanting to know more and being so frustrated at, like, the little crumb. Like, even writing this book, I feel like I had to develop my own research methodology. I had to figure all of this out because I could never find a mentor that knew enough about what I was trying to write about. It's not until now, you know, 6 years after starting, when the book is already about to be published, that I'm just now finding people like Javier Wallace. And so I think for me too, there's that kind of like grief of erasure and of wanting to know and just not having the resources prior to now.
Yeah. It's this tricky thing too. A lot of things going on. So there's this like conservative bigoted push to cancel critical race theory, right? And cultural mm-hmm. studies programs with this frustration and like juggling that bigotry with like the frustration that a lot of us have with these cultural studies programs where like they're not that radical. Let's just put that out there.
They're really not. Yeah.
Like Cassandra was going to a Chicano studies course where like we've talked about this a lot, but Cassandra has been presenting like radical anarchist Chicanx thought that really moved away from like the Antalduas and the, you know, and the Gloria, I mean, the, what's her name? Sherry Moragas of the world. And she was being shut down, like, because that wasn't Chicano history. Like, that did not have a place here. And I think about how often, this is a problem that I have as someone who's also trying to sometimes educate, right? Like, whenever I do something about, like, oh, for example, this is why we shouldn't use the term la raza to talk about all of, you know, people who would be called Latinx, right? I'm dealing with an audience who went to college and got told, this is our history. You should be proud of it. You should be proud of being La Raza. And so it's me, like, against these professors who base their entire research on these colonial, like, and these white supremacist thought processes, right? So, and that is considered by conservatives radical. So it's like, yeah. A part of me is like, abolish Chicano studies because it does so much bad.
Yeah.
Like we have all these kids who go into Chicano studies and feel empowered, not realizing that it's because they're being taught mestizo supremacy. And then they go off into the world and realize that they have to unlearn shit because they paid thousands of dollars per unit to learn about how to be bigots even more in an academic language. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I think about how you must have felt researching for this, researching Black history, right, as it pertained to the Americas, and realizing that you were thousands of dollars into a degree and you still had to find shit on YouTube and tweets and shit, right?
Right, right. Yeah, no, that feels very accurate to my experience.
How
Yeah, I don't know. What's up?
was up? How did you how did that inform this work, do you feel? Because I feel like found history is very present here.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, I even liked earlier when you were talking about the book that you mentioned, like that there's quotes from scholars, there's also like my own analysis, there's a section in one of the poems that's entirely just a Wikipedia paragraph. I feel like I was very interested in like I don't even know what to call it, but I guess I could say like rogue research, where when you kind of like you don't have a research mentor, right? I did take courses with Dr. Rachel Gonzalez at UT Austin, and she is trained in anthropology, I believe, and like studies of folklore. And so she taught me a lot about like cultural anthropology and like ethical research methods, especially when you're doing like oral history with communities. And so like I interviewed members of my family. I interviewed people who were in the military with my parents, which is a complicated conversation, about their memories of my father because he died before I was able to meet him. And so, and because, right, I'm studying this parts of history that are have not been taught to me, so I'm having to go to the library and find specific books where I can learn information about these things, or look on YouTube, or look on Wikipedia. What There's a reason that this book is not being published with like an academic press, right? Because it's not the traditional route of scholarship, right? Where you like have a research question and then you kind of have this very clear plan of how you're going to find this information. When I was writing this manuscript, I was always telling people it's like I open one door of information and then like 10 more doors open behind it, and I'm just trying to keep track of all of the doors. I'm not trying to necessarily like present a huge argument. I'm just trying to place things in relation to each other that seem connected to me, and just kind of present it, and then what people do with it is kind of up to them. So I think a good example of this is the poem Mustang in the collection. And this is interesting to me because the high school I went to in San Antonio, our mascot was the Mustangs. And so I have, school t-shirts that have this white Mustang on the cover of it. And it was something that we chanted, like John Jay Mustangs, at like football games and things like that. But then the Wikipedia entry about Mustangs, the way they describe these horses is very similar to me to the way that you would describe Maroons, people who escaped from slavery, right? Mustangs are not a particular breed of horse. They are descended from domestic horses that escaped into the wild and remained there to survive and reproduce. And those herds of wild horses are what we know now as Mustangs. I also went to school at UT Austin, and in one corner of campus, there's a large bronze statue called the Seven Mustangs, and there's a large inscription on it that's about Stephen F. Austin, right? Like one of the Anglos who colonized Texas and fought for Texas independence from Mexico. And he says, like one of the reasons we were able to win, against Mexico, he says, next to God, we owed our victory to the horses. And so I'm also thinking about Mustangs as this tool for war, this thing that is part of the natural world that now is being used for imperialist purposes. And me, right, someone who went to this high school with the Mustang as a mascot, and then kind of learning all of this history is just interesting to me as a person who's been in all of these spaces. And so I think a lot of the work of the manuscript is just trying to gather as much information as I can and try to put it in relation to each other and present it that way.
Like another big portion of this like research-based poetry is your trip to Mexico, right? And this t I don't know if I want to call it tension between being like, this is supposed to be somewhere where I feel at home as well, and yet finding rejection not only from most of your peers except for one person maybe, and also by the state. Right, how did this like tension, this violence, like inform these this selection?
Yeah. Well, before I answer that, I just want to ask, have either of y'all been to Mexico City before?
When
No, I
Mexico
haven't.
City, Mexico
I've
City,
only been.
Girl, growing up, going to Mexico meant like going to my grandma's rancho, and like we would never leave a rancho. I did not see.
Same.
And like rancho is being generous. And like my family's from Izúcar, so it is like it's a big city to folks from there, but it's like 20,000 people, right? So I would just walk around the Zócalo and stuff. I never went to, I don't even, my mom swears we went to the pyramids and shit, and to, but the only tourist that I can remember is like the bañarios, which are like water parks, quote unquote, but really that's just like a hole in the ground with like a bunch of water. And once, and like poorly made slides, because one time I went down a slide with my face forward and I chipped my tooth on the slide, and then I had a stripe of blue across my teeth for like a week.
Oh my
So
gosh.
all that's to say, no, I've never been to the touristy Mexico City.
No, same. I've gone. My family's from Torreon, and that's, I go to the rancho there, and that's pretty much the only place I go to. So no, I've never been there.
So what's up with Mexico
Yeah, I
City?
mean, I just asked because I f would you
I said,
say?
so what's up with Mexico City?
It's a problem.
It's a, like it's a problem. Like ah, you're a problem, or like, or like is Mexico City fine as shit, or is it like it's a problem? We gotta cancel it.
The second one, definitely we should, well, I mean, we should probably talk to people from there, but I feel like,
Abolish Mexico City. She said cancel them. She said none of this history of like the eagle landing on the nopal serpent thing of that indigenous people found that they were colonized. She said fuck that shit. Fuck. So cancel Mexico
oh
City, let's go.
my goodness. No, it's so funny. So, like, growing up in San Antonio, like, I'd only been to, I think Pedras Negras. We would go to the market there sometimes, but it was like a day trip, right? We would drive there a few hours, do our thing, and then drive back to San Antonio. But I'd never been deeper into Mexico. And I feel like it's interesting to me when you talk to other like Mexican Americans about Mexico City. Like I told my aunt that I was going for the study abroad, and she was like, "Oh, el DF," you know, and her eyes kind of like got big, and she was, "Okay, make sure you know you be safe and you pay attention because there's a lot of people there."
They're gonna shank you.
So, I, right.
That's why we that they were always tell us, no, you we're not going there because they're gonna shank you, little.
You know, like. I don't know. I didn't totally know what to expect going, but I think something that shows up a lot in the manuscript and in my experiences there was just like this really profound feeling of loneliness. Because so I went with a study abroad program that was mostly Mexican American students from my school, most of whom were bilingual, many of whom like had lived in Mexico before. And so I think for them, like going to Mexico City was this like very exciting, you know, almost like a vacation kind of thing. We're gonna go see all the, you know, all the tourist things. There were also like planned trips that were mandatory as part of my study abroad. So we did all the touristy things. We went to go see the pyramids and all of that. But something that I think was interesting for me, because I was the only black person on the trip, and because I did not see very many black people for the whole 6 weeks that I was there, anywhere that we went. I kind of was taking just a lot of notes on how people perceived me, like whether or not they believed that I spoke Spanish, whether or not they thought I was American or not, and like whether or not they, and like basically like how they encountered my blackness, right? There were a lot of interactions I had where I was speaking to, you know, vendors or people working in supermarkets or just regular people on the street, and we would kind of, you know, just be engaged in a regular conversation, and then at some point they would kind of realize that something was different about me, right? That I'm black. And then the way that they regarded me would change. Suddenly they had a lot of questions, right? Or they had to make a big spectacle of me being there. And when I say spectacle, I mean they were the same way that like people make a spectacle of black women's hair in the US. It was the same thing in Mexico City, to where like people, when seeing my hair, would call for their family members from the other side of the supermarket to come look at me, to come stare at me and ask me questions. And so for me, that felt very indicative, right? If I'm in Mexico City, right, like the site of all of this history that's supposed to be like the origin site of Mexico as a country, right? For me, that was very telling about how we understand Mexican identity, and who gets to be a part of that and who gets erased in the construction of the nation state. So the a lot of the poem, I have a long poem in the collection, Mexico City Scenes. It's just looking at the different, some of the different places that we travel to while there, and the kind of experiences that I had there with the one of the only friends that I had on that trip, and just kind of trying to navigate that, you know, like as a Black person in this place that you said, right? Like, I feel like that's one of the narratives too of like Mexican American studies, is that like when you go to Mexico, you're supposed to feel at home, right? These are your gente. And for me, like my Blackness was a barrier to that, and it was very clear. So the poems are a way of me kind of working that out.
A lot of things are coming to mind right now. Immediately I think about like you kind of calling out this this facade of like Pan Latinidad, specifically in how you talk about your friend Abuelito, I think you call them, who it was the only one who kept it real with you and wasn't trying to like relate to you on like this we're all Latino type of thing, right? They were like trying, they were like seeing you as a person, right? And mm-hmm. you responded to that. I think that was one of the pieces that I think folks will have something to think about in a more immediate way. I also think about how you said that you want to question like this idea of who gets to be Mexican, right? Of mm-hmm. And that's something that I've always explored also in my work of like, you know, not only Mexican nationalism but all nationalism, it's like who does it serve, mm-hmm. what is it for,
yes.
what is the point of this identity, right? And I know that somebody that we work with or you know share community with and then we have in common is Alan Palaez, and you mentioned mm-hmm. in previous conversations exchanges that they informed your work a lot, right? And mm-hmm. you know they're currently also in Mexico, which mm-hmm. is I feel like that unites this conversation a lot.
Yeah, it's been so funny. Alan actually wrote the foreword to the book. I don't think it was in the copy that I was able to send y'all because they were still working on it. But I really do feel like Alan as a person, like knowing them as a person and then also knowing their work, and also encountering your work, Ruben, like on Twitter, just all of the critiques that you had about Mexican nationalism, because I was very indoctrinated in Chicano studies. You know, I had my questions about it at the time, but like that nationalism piece was something I didn't know to even think about until encountering your work and Alan's work as well. Because I think for a while, when I was, what were you going to say?
Are we going to find pictures of you with your hand raised with like a picture of Selena in the background, like with your concha earrings? And like tweets about you being like,
yo soy... I've never had concha earrings.
You've been like, tweets of you being like, yo soy Daslan ese, or shit like that.
I don't think so. Not that I know of. I've never had concha earrings. I can say that definitively. It was my least favorite type of pan dulce.
Straight up. Okay. Oh no, Cassandra likes conchas. I forget.
I do.
They're
I
so
do.
Dry.
It's whack.
I'm a dry bitch, I guess.
She's got that dap. That dry ass pussy.
You know what? You can have conchas if I can have flour tortillas, you know, and I feel like we can just call it even.
All right.
You're saying you're really indoctrinated. You're very indoctrinated.
Oh, yeah, into Chicano studies for a while. So, like, that nationalism piece was something I didn't know to critique for a while. But it really helped me with, like, because I feel like... you were mentioning earlier, right, like the question of like who gets to be Mexican, I feel like has been a question for me all my life, but it wasn't until like these last few years of really thinking through what are the problems with Mexican nationalism that I was like, I don't think I care anymore about like Mexicanidad. And that's kind of where like the poems in this book like arrive at, like, that conclusion, right, that that's actually not important. That's why the book is focused on Black relationality. Whether the Black people that I'm in relation with are in Mexico, or they're African American, or they're Afro-Caribbean, that for me is a much more important link than Pan Latinidad, right, which could be literally anybody anywhere, I feel like, for the most part. Yeah,
there's this meme of SpongeBob like washing his hands, and like there's a sign that says employees must wash hands, los empleados se deben de lavar las manos, like a bilingual sign in his restroom, and somebody was like, so Bikini Bottom is like a Chicano, like a Texas like place, because obviously everything is bilingual, so there's like a strong Hispanic population, so for all we know SpongeBob could be Latinx too.
I'm so over it. Like, who cares? He's a sponge.
Okay, so you're trying to erase his Latinx identity? I mean, Sandy's from fucking Texas.
Maybe. She is, actually, yeah. I feel like Sandy's a white woman from Texas.
Oh, she's straight up a white woman. But this, speaking of SpongeBob, I just play. But speaking of like who gets to fit this like national or like ethnic identity, I feel like you also speak in your poems about like this rejection or expansion of like gender assumptions. I don't even want to say like gender roles, and questioning where your like queerness or gender fits into this, right?
Yeah, I have a lot of thoughts about this that I don't know if I've verbalized a lot, but so I'm gonna try to.
Do it.
It was so funny because when Alan read this book, exclusive, dropping worldwide. It was funny to me because I sent this manuscript to Alan. Just like to help me think through some of the things in it. And when Alan read it, they were like, this book is actually not about race. This book is about gender. And then they like outlined this whole like theoretical discussion, as Alan does, you know. And I was like, you know, this is very helpful for me to sit with and think through. So in the Mexico City poems, you mentioned earlier that there's like the character of the güero, who is like my friend, and one of my only real friends while being in DF. And, like, there's a point in the poem Mexico City Scenes where, you know, my character, the speaker of the poem, is attracted to the güero and is, like, curious about, like, the possibility of love there. But I think, for me, then the nation state kind of gets in the way. And for me, this is also a replication of what happens with my parents at the beginning of the book, right? Like my parents were in the Air Force. My father died in a plane crash during a routine training mission. Two planes crashed in the air and there were no survivors. This happened while my mother was pregnant with me. And so like my parents had this whole plan of they were going to get married, you know, they were going to go to school and, you know, have a child and have a house and kind of all the things about like the quote unquote American dream, right? That we're supposed to aspire to be like good citizens or whatever. But the nation state and its violence interrupted that pattern, right? So my mother was not able to like, to achieve that kind of like cis heteropatriarchal standard of life because of the violence of the nation state and like my parents' complicity in that by being part of the military. And so that's like the first interruption of the nation state in my own origin story, in my own life, right? That makes me question the thing that I'm supposed to be aspiring to. And so then later when my relationship with the güero like becomes like a possibility, right, I as a person and as the writer and the character in that poem have to ask myself, is this something that I want? Is this something that serves me? Or am I so starved for community that this is the thing that I am latching onto? And so later in the book I kind of reject that altogether. I say something like, I choose something braver, like I go search for the missing parts of me instead. I go fill in the blanks because I think I'm much more interested in the possibilities of queerness, the possibilities of Blackness than I am in güeros as a whole, as a genre of people. I've seen enough. I got it. I got the message.
Thanks for breaking that down. I feel like I read the manuscript that you sent, and like I, you know, you understand what you're reading, but like hearing you and like the background and how, like I, you know, reading from like how you wrote about like your father and him dying when your mom was pregnant in a plane crash, and then it, the Weddle story is not, you know, for a couple pages, but now that you like, you just, you know, they like inform one another, like I'm like, oh my god, like my mind is blown right now. Like now I like need to go back and like read it, you know, like because now I know like how, why you wrote it, or like just like detailed information about it. So that's awesome.
Yeah, well, like the link is the nation state, right? The nation state and its many violences, because it's not just the military, right? It's not just cis heteropatriarchy. It's not just anti-blackness, right? It's all of these things at the same time, right? Across histories, across geographies, across places, across families and different kinds of relationships. And so I was very interested in the very intimate ways that the logics of the nation state show up in our everyday lives and the choices that we make.
Yeah, because nationhood by nature, it separates us all into us and them, right? And so when it comes to interpersonal relationships, it immediately sets like, who is us, who is them, how can we relate to them if they're not us, like, you know. So yeah, I completely see that. And so I think this like us versus them thing is something that's actually reinforced in Chicano studies stuff. Even just look at like looking at the foundational, like the Chicano manifesto, it sets people up as like this like bronze empire, right? Like who is bronze, like who is this, you know, this thing, and who does this empire belong to, right? And what is Aslan if not another colony, right? So, and a lot of this is shit that people accept as law a lot of times because it is what their professors, what their mentors teach them, right? And one of the immediate things that you right off the bat said is like in the first pages of your book was like, you know, we gotta throw like a lot of these Anzaldúa borderlands interpretations away, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the first lines of the first poem in the book is we need new origins. Because I think, again, like this concept of origin stories for me is one of the through lines of the book. Like what are the stories we tell ourselves about who we are and how we got to be here? I talk to Alan about this all the time, but I feel like coming from Black Studies, which for me was my foundational degree, and it's the analysis through which I think about everything, including poems. In Black Studies, I feel like the foundational question of that discipline is how do we achieve liberation? And then all the other kind of questions branch off of that, right? What precedents are there? What have people done in the past? What are people doing now? What is not serving the purposes of liberation? And so when I got to Mexican American Studies, the foundational question of Mexican American Studies seems to be, who are we as people? Which is like, what is the goal of that? You know, do you know what I mean? Like, that's not a politic to like, that's actually like eugenics in a lot of ways, right? Who are we as people? Because again, right, like you were saying, we have to define who is not us. And so when you were like, abolish the whole discipline, that's how I feel. what goal is it? Is it serving? So in the manuscript, I'm thinking a lot about origin stories and if they are useful or not. Or if so, how can we make them less romantic than just the actual truth of what happened? So for me, that means doing away with borderlands, right? There was this point when I thought that I was going to do like erasure poems, like blackout poems of Borderlands, the book. So I read the whole thing cover to cover, and afterwards I was like, I feel terrible. But I also didn't want to use Anzaldúa's language. I was like, I feel like plenty of people are already writing about her and dialoguing about her work. So actually, I'm going to reject a lot of what she does in that book and instead like make, I have like a borderland suite of poems, a collection of poems in the book that are kind of about like the ways that the logic of mestizaje and the logic of borderlands is flawed and how that shows up in some of my own experiences, and just kind of me being like, no, 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 and no.
Yeah. It's interesting that you say, you know, it's like who we are as people, because I feel like that actually does sum up like Chicanismo. It's always like, and that's like, you know, we've talked a lot about Mexican nationalism and Chicano nationalism on this podcast like forever, but it is like, who are we? And like, who, you know what I mean? Like, we are indigenous and we are brown and we're from Aslan, and it's always like very identity.
And we are Joaquin.
Like, identity itself is like not correct, but it's always like, mm-hmm. yeah, this romanticization of who we are and where we come from. And it's not, first it's not accurate, but even then mm-hmm. it's like, that's the only thing. There's no, there's like nothing else happening. And it, you know, how we mentioned, like, even from the 70s, like, there has been really no progression, because that's all it's based on, like, mm-hmm. identity, wrong identity at that. Mm-hmm. But it's like, who are we excluding, or we are excluding these other, you know, like, mm-hmm. that is nationalism. And that is pretty much like Chicanismo, like, who are we? And so anyone that strays from that is like, no, you know, like, you're just a gatekeeper, whatever they, you know, whatever they say. But yeah, it's just, it's just funny, kind of ironic that is like Chicanismo, you know?
Yeah. And I think that one of the tensions that your work has faced, Ariana, is when speaking directly about, like, you know, abolishing, like, the borderlands industrial complex, like, you have a lot of people who, how do I say this,
don't like that
because they don't like that, because this is all they have, and it's all the potent, like, the work they want to think put into thinking about identity, right? Like, I think about often how I'm just like, yeah, fuck this fucked up, you know, cultural studies shit. And how at the same time, like I mentioned at the start of the thing, it's like, you know, for some people, Chicano studies is the most radical, most empowering thing in the world to them. So how do you juggle, like, wanting to do that with, like, the pushback that you get from people who, like, don't, that they're so afraid of leaving that? Because if they leave that, then what are they?
Yeah. I mean, I think that's the question, right? Like, that's also, I feel like that same question is in the book, just written in a different way. Like, I think in the very first poem, at the end of The Borderlands, is the name of the first poem in the book, there's the line, like, who are you without your country? I think there's such a push for, you know, quote unquote, people of color, because not all Mexican Americans are actually people of color. The Hueros walk among us. And I say this everywhere I go, because it seems like people are confused about that. But like, there's such a push in the U.S. among, like, quote unquote, people of color to really identify with our heritage countries, and use that as a source of, like, our own empowerment or whatever. Something that's been helpful is thinking about, like, who is the most oppressed, or who are the oppressed groups in our heritage countries, and how do they feel about us doing that, and who does that actually serve? So I very much feel, you know, done with Chicano studies. And I think when I encounter people who are very invested in it still, at first I'm kind of like, really? And then I'm like, okay, whatever. You know, you weren't trying to hear from me anyway. And so it is funny, though, because since I'm a touring artist, I get invited to do a lot of events at, like, Latinx student organizations, or, you know, like, Latinx Heritage Month events or whatever. And that's always strange. Particularly when they put me in conversation with other speakers or scholars whose work is totally opposite of what I'm doing. People who are, you know, still writing about borderlands or still studying Anzaldúa. And, you know, I kind of just tell myself, like, that work is not for me. It's not about me. My work is interested in something different. So I will continue to be loud about what I believe in, and the people who are looking for it will find me. Because you'd be surprised, every time I, like, post about the anti-blackness in Borderlands, or the way that Anzaldúa's legacy is taught, there's always people who have been in Chicano studies classrooms who reach out to me, and they're like, I had the same feeling. Like, it felt weird to me too, or I'm Indigenous, and I didn't like the way that she talked about like appropriating all of these different kinds of Indigenous cultures and languages. But my professor wouldn't listen to me or thought I was crazy or something. So I think that there's more of us out there than we might know. And I think it takes, you know, things like this podcast, books like Alan as well, being loud about how we feel, because we are not the only ones. We're not the only ones.
To end this portion, I think, thank you for talking about your book. We'll be back after the break to go through a couple things with Ariana. Put them in the hot seat. We will go, we'll be right back.
Planned Parenthood asked me to show someone how I see them, like really see them. So in this ad, I'll dedicate to you, Cassandra. I really see the way you are switching it up with your hair recently and how that shows how adventurous and like no F's given attitude you have. And I really respect that because I'm someone that is too self-conscious sometimes. So like seeing you be daring, I feel really lucky to see you, like the real you.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Well, Planned Parenthood sees you, truly sees you, not just as patients, but as people. Visit www.beseen.org to learn more.
All right, all right. And we are back. All right, so...
Okay. All right. We're going to end the episode. We're talking about the thing that's made us less bitter this week, right? It can be anything at all. I am going to have Cassandra go first, then me, and then you can close the episode, Ariana.
On a few days ago, I went to Hot Springs with one of my best friends for her birthday, and we went to Hot Springs, and I haven't been there in like... I don't know how long. It's 2 hours away from El Paso. El Paso doesn't have like a body of water. We're in the fucking desert. Like we have swimming pools, but there's like, you know, there's no lakes. There's no, we used to have a river. There's no river anymore. You know, thanks imperialism and the wall that we already have. Cause we do have a fucking wall. So we just wanted to get out of El Paso, even if it was just like a 2-hour drive, just fucking for a few hours, because it's been hard out here, you know? That brought me joy. Just being able to just fucking go somewhere and spend time with one of my best friends. Mm. That made me less bitter. That's my mom vacation. That was my mom vacation getaway.
Aw. Well, I don't know if I've said...
I do miss my child, okay? I'm all like, it's been so great. I don't have responsibilities. I'm like, I miss my child, I do.
Both things can be true at the same time.
He is fine. What about you, Ruben?
You know, ending the quarter has made me less bitter. But also made me more bitter because... I've had to face the fact that, like, again, and it's a lesson we always learn, like, academia is violent as shit. So just, like, running on -3 spoons this whole fucking year since, like, them not giving me, not letting me take a quarter off without losing my funding after my father's passing, like, I've had to carry that weight, but recently I've been like, that was fucked up of them. Like, and so just kind of, yeah. Now that I've had time to breathe a little bit more, that the quarter is over, I'm just like, I really hate that. So ending the quarter is making me less bitter. And I don't know if I've already said this, but opening a Neopets account, game changer. It is.
I love that for you.
It is stupid. Don't do it. But it's been entertaining.
Wait, I have a follow-up. Have you had a Neopets account before? Like, is this a throwback?
Yeah, it's a throwback. Oh, girl, I used to be a fucking... I used to be Jeff Bezos and Neopets back in the day. Like, I was rich. Like, because I, like, figured out how to make all the points and shit. And so, like, I'm already at, like, 1.5 million Neopoints, which is...
Oh, my God.
Yeah. Like,
No, you need to be canceled immediately.
No, I'm living my best Damn Boss fantasy.
We need Neopets. To tax you.
You're not gonna
You are the ultimate like girl boss.
I am super girl boss. No need to have a special guest here to talk about girl bossness when you got me. Like
resident expert. Oh my gosh.
And what about you, Ariana?
Yeah, something that made me less bitter this week. I went to not a demonstration, but like I've been in contact with the local tenants union here because I was supposed to move into my apartment at the beginning of this month, and there's like roaches and a whole bunch of other concerns. I haven't actually moved in yet. I've been staying with family. So I reached out to a local tenants union for help, and they invited me to a thing they were doing a few nights ago, where they were delivering a demand letter to someone's landlord, someone who had been living with unlivable conditions for a long period of time. And so they just needed bodies, you know, to like be on the sidewalk and in the street to be present at the landlord's house while they read the list of demands, and said that they were, if the demands were not met, that they were going to escalate. And I think just being there and being physically present and using my body and my voice felt really good in support of another tenant. And yeah, I don't know. It also made me feel like the struggle that I'm having with my current apartment complex is winnable and doable. It felt really good, I think, to know that, and not just to know, but to feel it, you know? So that's something that made me less bitter this week.
Aw, we have all this fake shit, and she's like, being united with this.
I know, we're like Neopets. We went on a road trip.
These are also important things, okay? Like, this is just at the forefront of my mind because I'm living in my family's like extra room, and I would very much like to be in my own apartment.
Oh,
no, I get it. Yeah, and fuck landlords, like, just fuck them forever.
The worst. Yeah. Those are the Jeff Bezos that we need to be worried about.
Fight the real enemy. Fight like Senator Connor said. Thank you so much for being here, Ariana. It's been.
Thank you, Aranya. I'm sorry, Aranya.
That's your friend.
That's my friend's name. I'm sorry. That's my friend. I'm so sorry.
Yeah, we are not the same.
You're like, who is that? I don't know her. No, thank you so much for coming on. Thank you for letting us read your book, your manuscript. I'm going to reread it now that we've had this conversation. And so for anyone who's listening to this, when this whenever we release this and you're listening to it, you need to pre-order the book, and then you'll have like read it and then listen to this, and then, well, no, that's my, you know what I mean, like after listening to this exclusive interview, you will be like, damn, all right, I understand this like on a deeper level. So that's what I'm going to do. That's what you should do, too.
Yeah. And the book, again, is We Are Owed by Ariana Brown. And you can find Ariana at Ariana the Poet across social media, except for TikTok. She don't fuck with Gen Z like that. and then Ariana Brown on YouTube, and then arianabrown.com for bookings and other information.
Yes.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yes. Been great.
Thank you, and thank you all for listening, and we'll see you again soon.
Yeah, all right, y'all, take care. Bye.
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 Before we head out, we want to give a huge shout out to all of our patrons once again, especially those in our I Know Her level tier, and that would be Abigail D, Aranya, Ames T, Alana F, Alejandro M, Ali T, Amy, Bianca, Brenda C, Clara P, Chrissy J, Danielle V, Erika A, Gianna R O, Jen A, Jocelyn D, Justine, Kimberly, Layla G, Linda M, Lizbeth K, Magdalena S, Miguel B, Nancy M M, Natasha B, Ronnie L, Sarah M, Tate, Valentina R, Vanessa, Yasmin, and Yulisa. Y'all are amazing. Thank you so much for supporting us and really believing in Bitter Brown Fans. All right. Love y'all a ton. Bye.